The Magic of Reality, How We Know What's Really True. Written by Richard Dawkins and read by Richard Dawkins
and Lala Ward.
Chapter 1. What is reality? What is magic? Reality is everything that exists. That sounds straightforward, doesn't it? Actually, it isn't. There are various problems. What about dinosaurs which once existed but exist no longer? What about stars which are so far away that, by the time their light reaches us and we can see them, they may have fizzled out? We'll come to dinosaurs and stars in a moment. But in any case, how do we know things exist even in the present? Well, our five senses, sight, smell, touch, hearing and taste, do a pretty good job of convincing us that many things are real. Rocks and camels, newly mown grass and freshly ground coffee, sandpaper and velvet, waterfalls and doorbells, sugar and salt. But are we only going to call something real if we can detect it directly with one of our five senses? What about a distant galaxy too far away to be seen with the naked eye? What about a bacterium too small to be seen without a powerful microscope? Must we say that these do not exist because we can't see them? No. Obviously, we can enhance our senses through the use of special instruments, telescopes for the galaxy, microscopes for bacteria. Because we understand telescopes and microscopes and how they work, we can use them to extend the reach of our senses, in this case the sense of sight, and what they enable us to see convinces us that galaxies and bacteria exist. How about radio waves? Do they exist? Our eyes can't detect them, nor can our ears, but again, special instruments, television sets for example, convert them into signals that we can see and hear. So although we can't see or hear radio waves, we know they are a part of reality. As with telescopes and microscopes, we understand how radios and televisions work. So they enable our senses to build a picture of what exists, the real world, reality. Radio telescopes and X-ray telescopes show us stars and galaxies through what seem like different eyes. Another way to expand our view of reality. Back to those dinosaurs. How do we know that they once roamed the Earth? We've never seen them or heard them or had to run away from them. Alas, we don't have a time machine to show them to us directly. But here we have a different kind of aid to our senses. We have fossils, and we can see them with the naked eye. Fossils don't run and jump, but because we understand how fossils are formed, they can tell us something of what happened millions of years ago. We understand how water, with minerals dissolved in it, seeps into corpses buried in layers of mud and rock. We understand how the minerals crystallize out of the water and replace the materials of the corpse, atom by atom, leaving some trace of the original animal's form imprinted on the stone. So, although we can't see dinosaurs directly with our senses, we can work out that they must have existed using indirect evidence that still ultimately reaches us through our senses. We see and touch the stony traces of ancient life. In a different sense, a telescope can work like a kind of time machine. What we see when we look at anything is actually light, and light takes time to travel. Even when you look at a friend's face, you're seeing them in the past, because the light from their face takes a tiny fraction of a second to travel to your eye. Sound travels much more slowly, which is why you see a firework burst in the sky noticeably earlier than you hear the bang. When you watch a man chopping down a tree in the distance, there's an odd delay in the sound of his axe hitting the tree.
Light travels so fast that we normally assume anything we see happens at the instant we see it. But stars are another matter. Even the sun is 8 light minutes away. If the sun blew up, this catastrophic event wouldn't become a part of our reality until 8 minutes later. And that would be the end of us. As for the next nearest star, Proxima Centauri, if you look at it in 2011, what you are seeing is happening in 2007. Galaxies are huge collections of stars. We are in one galaxy called the Milky Way. When you look at the Milky Way's next-door neighbor, the Andromeda Galaxy, your telescope is a time machine taking you back 2.5 million years. There's a cluster of 5 galaxies called Stefan's Quintet, which we see through the Hubble telescope, spectacularly colliding with each other. But we see them colliding 280 million years ago. If there are aliens in one of those colliding galaxies, with a telescope powerful enough to see us, what they are seeing on Earth at this very moment, here and now, is the early ancestors of the dinosaurs. Are there really aliens in outer space? We've never seen or heard them. Are they a part of reality? Nobody knows. But we do know what kind of things could one day tell us if they are. If ever we got near to an alien, our sense organs could tell us about it. Perhaps somebody will one day invent a telescope powerful enough to detect life on other planets from here. Or perhaps our radio telescopes will pick up messages that could only have come from an alien intelligence. For reality doesn't just consist of the things we already know about. It also includes things that exist, but that we don't know about yet, and won't know about until some future time, perhaps when we have built better instruments to assist our 5 senses. Atoms have always existed, but it was only rather recently that we became sure of their existence, and it's likely that our descendants will know about many more things that for now we do not. That is the wonder and the joy of science. It goes on and on, uncovering new things. This doesn't mean we should believe just anything that anybody might dream up. There are a million things we can imagine, but which are highly unlikely to be real. Fairies and hobgoblins, leprechauns and hippogriffs. We should always be open-minded, but the only good reason to believe that something exists is if there is real evidence that it does.
Models, testing our imagination. There is a less familiar way in which a scientist can work out what is real when our 5 senses cannot detect it directly. This is through the use of a model of what might be going on, which can then be tested. We imagine, you might say we guess, what might be there. That is called the model. We then work out, often by doing a mathematical calculation, what we ought to see or hear, etc., often with the help of measuring instruments, if the model were true. We then check whether that is what we actually do see. The model might literally be a replica made out of wood or plastic, or it might be a piece of mathematics on paper, or it might be a simulation in a computer. We look carefully at the model and predict what we ought to see or hear if the model were correct. Then we look to see whether the predictions are right or wrong. If they are right, this increases our confidence that the model really does represent reality. We then go on to devise further experiments, perhaps refining the model, to test the findings further and confirm them. If our predictions are wrong, we reject the model, or modify it and try again. Here's an example. Nowadays we know that genes, the units of heredity, are made of stuff called DNA. We know a great deal about DNA and how it works, but you can't see the details of what DNA looks like, even with a powerful microscope. Almost everything we know about DNA comes indirectly from dreaming up models and then testing them. Actually, long before anyone had even heard of DNA, scientists already knew lots about genes from testing the predictions of models. Back in the 19th century, an Austrian monk called Gregor Mendel did experiments in his monastery garden, breeding peas in large quantities. He counted the numbers of plants that had flowers of various colours, or that had peas that were wrinkly or smooth, as the generations went by. Mendel never saw or touched a gene. All he saw were peas and flowers, and he could use his eyes to count different types. He invented a model, which involved what we would now call genes, though Mendel didn't call them that, and he calculated that if his model were correct, in a particular breeding experiment, there ought to be 3 times as many smooth peas as wrinkly ones. And that is what he found when he counted them. Leaving aside the details, the point is that Mendel's genes were an invention of his imagination. He couldn't see them with his eyes, not even with a microscope. But he could see smooth and wrinkled peas, and by counting them, he found indirect evidence that his model of heredity was a good representation of something in the real world. Later scientists used a modification of Mendel's method, working with other living things such as fruit flies instead of peas, to show that genes are strung out in a definite order along threads called chromosomes. We humans have 46 chromosomes, fruit flies have 8. It was even possible to work out, by testing models, the exact order in which genes were arranged along chromosomes. All this was done long before we knew that genes were made of DNA.
Nowadays, we know this, and we know exactly how DNA works, thanks to James Watson and Francis Crick, plus a lot of other scientists who came after them. Watson and Crick could not see DNA with their own eyes. Once again, they made their discoveries by imagining models and testing them. In their case, they literally built metal and cardboard models of what DNA might look like, and they calculated what certain measurements ought to be if those models were correct. The predictions of one model, the so-called double helix model, exactly fitted the measurements made by Rosalind Franklin and Morris Wilkins using special instruments involving X-rays beamed into crystals of purified DNA. Watson and Crick also immediately realized that their model of the structure of DNA would produce exactly the kind of results seen by Gregor Mendel in his monastery garden. We come to know what is real, then, in one of three ways. We can detect it directly, using our five senses, or indirectly, using our senses aided by special instruments, such as telescopes and microscopes, or even more indirectly, by creating models of what might be real, and then testing those models to see whether they successfully predict things that we can see or hear, etc., with or without the aid of instruments. Ultimately, it always comes back to our senses, one way or another. Does this mean that reality only contains things that can be detected, directly or indirectly, by our senses and by the methods of science? What about things like jealousy and joy, happiness and love? Are these not also real? Yes, they are real, but they depend for their existence on brains. Human brains, certainly, and probably the brains of other advanced animal species, such as chimpanzees, dogs and whales, too. Rocks don't feel joy or jealousy, and mountains do not love. These emotions are intensely real to those who experience them, but they didn't exist before brains did. It is possible that emotions like these, and perhaps other emotions that we can't begin to dream of, could exist on other planets, but only if those planets also contain brains, or something equivalent to brains, for who knows what weird thinking organs or feeling machines may lurk elsewhere in the universe.
Science and the supernatural, explanation and its enemy. So that is reality, and that is how we can know whether something is real or not. Each chapter of this book is going to be about one particular aspect of reality, the sun, for instance, or earthquakes, or rainbows, or the many different kinds of animals. I want now to turn to the other key word of my title, magic. Magic is a slippery word. It is commonly used in three different ways, and the first thing I must do is distinguish between them. I'll call the first one supernatural magic, the second one stage magic, and the third one, which is my favourite meaning and the one I intend in my title, poetic magic. Supernatural magic is the kind of magic we find in myths and fairy tales. In miracles, too, though I shall leave those to one side for now and return to them in the final chapter. It's the magic of Aladdin's lamp, of wizard spells, of the Brothers Grimm, of Hans Christian Andersen, and of J.K. Rowling. It's the fictional magic of a witch casting a spell and turning a prince into a frog, or a fairy godmother changing a pumpkin into a gleaming coach. These are the stories we all remember with fondness from our childhood, and many of us still enjoy when served up in a traditional Christmas pantomime. But we all know this kind of magic is just fiction and does not happen in reality. Stage magic, by contrast, really does happen, and it can be great fun. Or at least something really happens, though it isn't what the audience thinks it is. A man on a stage, it usually is a man for some reason, deceives us into thinking that something astonishing has happened. It may even seem supernatural, when what really happened was something quite different. Silk handkerchiefs cannot turn into rabbits, any more than frogs can turn into princes. What we've seen on the stage is only a trick. Our eyes have deceived us, or rather, the conjurer has gone to great pains to deceive our eyes, perhaps by cleverly using words to distract us from what he's really doing with his hands. Some conjurers are honest and go out of their way to make sure their audience know that they have simply performed a trick. I'm thinking of people like James the Amazing Randi, or Penn and Teller, or Derren Brown. Even though these admirable performers don't usually tell the audience exactly how they did the trick, they could be thrown out of the magic circle, the Conjurer's Club, if they did that, they do make sure the audience knows that there was no supernatural magic involved. Others don't actively spell out that it was just a trick, but they don't make exaggerated claims about what they've done either. They just leave the audience with the rather enjoyable sensation that something mysterious has happened, without actively lying about it. But unfortunately, there are some conjurers who are deliberately dishonest, and who pretend they really do have supernatural or paranormal powers. Perhaps they claim that they really can bend metal or stop clocks by the power of thought alone. Some of these dishonest fakes, charlatans is a good word for them, earn large fees from mining or oil companies by claiming that they can tell, using psychic powers, where would be a good place to drill. Other charlatans exploit people who are grieving by claiming to be able to make contact with the dead. When this happens, it is no longer just fun or entertainment, but preying on people's gullibility and distress. To be fair, it may be that not all of these people are charlatans. Some of them may sincerely believe they are talking to the dead. The third meaning of magic is the one I mean in my title, poetic magic. We are moved to tears by a beautiful piece of music, and we describe the performance as magical. We gaze up at the stars on a dark night with no moon and no city lights, and, breathless with joy, we say the sight is pure magic. We might use the same word to describe a gorgeous sunset, or an alpine landscape, or a rainbow against a dark sky. In this sense, magical simply means deeply moving, exhilarating, something that gives us goosebumps, something that makes us feel more fully alive. What I hope to show you in this book is that reality, the facts of the real world as understood through the methods of science, are magical in this third sense, the poetic sense, the good-to-be-alive sense. Now I want to return to the idea of the supernatural and explain why it can never offer us a true explanation of the things we see in the world and universe around us. Indeed, to claim a supernatural explanation of something is not to explain it at all, and even worse, to rule out any possibility of its ever being explained. Why do I say that? Because anything supernatural must by definition be beyond the reach of a natural explanation. It must be beyond the reach of science and the well-established, tried and tested scientific method that has been responsible for the huge advances in knowledge that we've enjoyed over the last 400 years or so. To say that something happens supernaturally is not just to say we don't understand it, but to say we will never understand it, so don't even try. Science takes exactly the opposite approach. Science thrives on its inability, so far, to explain everything, and uses that as the spur to go on asking questions, creating possible models and testing them, so that we make our way, inch by inch, closer to the truth. If something were to happen that went against our current understanding of reality, scientists would see that as a challenge to our present model, requiring us to abandon or at least change it. It is through such adjustments and subsequent testing that we approach closer and closer to what is true. What would you think of a detective who, baffled by a murder, was too lazy even to try to work at the problem, and instead wrote the mystery off as supernatural? The whole history of science shows us that things once thought to be the result of the supernatural, caused by gods, both happy and angry, demons, witches, spirits, curses and spells, actually do have natural explanations, explanations that we can understand and test and have confidence in. There is absolutely no reason to believe that those things for which science does not yet have natural explanations will turn out to be of supernatural origin, any more than volcanoes or earthquakes or diseases turn out to be caused by angry deities, as people once believed they were. Of course, no one really believes that it would be possible to turn a frog into a prince, or was it a prince into a frog, I can never remember, or a pumpkin into a coach. But have you ever stopped to consider why such things would be impossible? There are various ways of explaining it. My favourite way is this. Frogs and coaches are complicated things, with lots of parts that need to be put together in a special way, in a special pattern that can't just happen by accident or by a wave of a wand. That's what complicated means. It is very difficult to make a complicated thing like a frog or a coach. To make a coach, you need to bring all the parts together in just the right way. You need the skills of a carpenter and other craftsmen. Coaches don't just happen by chance or by snapping your fingers and saying, abracadabra. A coach has structure, complexity, working parts, wheels and axles, windows and doors, springs and padded seats. It would be relatively easy to turn something complicated like a coach into something simple. Like ash, for instance, the fairy godmother's wand would just need a built-in blowtorch. It's easy to turn almost anything into ash, but no one could take a pile of ash, or a pumpkin, and turn it into a coach, because a coach is too complicated, and not just complicated, but complicated in a useful direction. In this case, useful for people to travel in.
Let's make it a bit easier for the fairy godmother by supposing that instead of calling for a pumpkin, she'd called for all the parts you need for assembling a coach, all jumbled together in a box like a kit for building a model plane. The kit for making a coach consists of hundreds of planks of wood, panes of glass, rods and bars of iron, wads of padding and sheets of leather, along with nails, screws and pots of glue to hold things together. Now suppose that instead of reading the instructions and joining the parts in an orderly sequence, she just put all the bits into a great big bag and shook them up. What are the chances that the parts would happen to stick themselves together in just the right way to assemble a working coach? The answer is effectively zero. And a part of the reason for that is the massive number of possible ways in which you could combine the shuffled bits and pieces which would not result in a working coach or a working anything. If you take a load of parts and shake them around at random, they may just occasionally fall into a pattern that is useful or that we otherwise recognize as somehow special. But the number of ways in which that can happen is tiny, very tiny indeed, compared with the number of ways in which they will fall into a pattern that we don't recognize as anything more than a heap of junk. There are millions of ways of shuffling and reshuffling a heap of bits and pieces, millions of ways of transforming them into another heap of bits and pieces. Every time you shuffle them, you get a unique heap of junk that has never been seen before, but only a tiny minority of those millions of possible heaps will do anything useful, such as taking you to the ball, or will be remarkable or memorable in any way.
Sometimes we can literally count the number of ways you can reshuffle a series of bits, as with a pack of cards, for instance, where the bits are the individual cards. Suppose the dealer shuffles the pack and deals them out to four players so that they each have 13 cards. I pick up my hand and gasp in astonishment. I have a complete hand of 13 spades, all the spades. I'm too startled to go on with the game, and I show my hand to the other three players, knowing they will be as amazed as I am. But then, one by one, each of the other players lays his cards on the table, and the gasps of astonishment grow with each hand. Every one of them has a perfect hand. One has 13 hearts, another has 13 diamonds, and the last one has 13 clubs. Would this be supernatural magic? We might be tempted to think so. Mathematicians can calculate the chance of such a remarkable deal happening purely by accident. It turns out to be almost impossibly small. 1 in 536 octillion, 447 septillion, 737 sextillion, 765 quintillion, 488 quadrillion, 792 trillion, 839 billion, 237 million, 440,000. If you sat down and played cards for a trillion years, you might on one occasion get a perfect deal like that. But, and here's the thing, this deal is no more unlikely than every other deal of cards that has ever happened. The chance of any particular deal of 52 cards is 1 in 536 octillion, 447 septillion, 737 sextillion, 765 quintillion, 488 quadrillion, 792 trillion, 839 billion, 237 million, 440,000. Because that is the total number of all possible deals. It is just that we don't notice any particular pattern in the vast majority of deals that are made, so they don't strike us as anything out of the ordinary. We only notice the deals that happen to stand out in some way. There are billions of things you could turn a prince into if you were brutal enough to rearrange his bits into billions of combinations at random. But most of those combinations would look like a mess, like all those billions of meaningless random hands of cards that have been dealt. Only a tiny minority of those possible combinations of randomly shuffled prince bits would be recognizable or good for anything at all, let alone a frog. Princes don't turn into frogs and pumpkins don't turn into coaches, because frogs and coaches are complicated things whose bits could have been combined into an almost infinite number of heaps of junk. And yet we know, as a fact, that every living thing, every human, every crocodile, every blackbird, every tree, and even every Brussels sprout, has evolved from other, originally simpler forms. So isn't that just a process of luck or a kind of magic? No, absolutely not. This is a very common misunderstanding, so I want to explain right now why what we see in real life is not the result of chance or luck or anything remotely magical at all, except, of course, in the strictly poetic sense, of something that fills us with awe and delight.
The slow magic of evolution. To turn one complex organism into another complex organism in a single step, as in a fairy tale, would indeed be beyond the realms of realistic possibility. And yet, complex organisms do exist. So how did they arise? How, in reality, did complicated things like frogs and lions, baboons and banyan trees, princes and pumpkins, you and I, come into existence?
For most of history, that was a baffling question, which no one could answer properly. People therefore invented stories to try to explain it. But then the question was answered, and answered brilliantly, in the 19th century by one of the greatest scientists who ever lived, Charles Darwin. I'll use the rest of this chapter to explain his answer briefly and in different words from Darwin's own. The answer is that complex organisms like humans, crocodiles, and Brussels sprouts did not come about suddenly in one fell swoop, but gradually, step by tiny step, so that what was there after each step was only a little bit different from what was already there before. Imagine you wanted to create a frog with long legs. You could give yourself a good start by beginning with something that was already a bit like what you wanted to achieve, a frog with short legs, say. You would look over your short-legged frogs and measure their legs. You'd pick a few males and a few females that had slightly longer legs than most, and you'd let them mate together, while preventing their short-legged friends from mating at all. The longer-legged males and females would make tadpoles together, and these would eventually grow legs and become frogs. Then you'd measure this new generation of frogs, and once again pick out those males and females that had longer-than-average legs, and put them together to mate. After doing this for about 10 generations, you might start to notice something interesting. The average leg length of your population of frogs would now be noticeably longer than the average leg length of the starting population. You might even find that all the frogs of the 10th generation had longer legs than any of the frogs of the first generation. Or 10 generations might not be enough to achieve this. You might need to go on for 20 generations or even more. But eventually, you could proudly say, "I have made a new kind of frog with longer legs than the old type." No wand was needed. No magic of any kind was required. What we have here is the process called selective breeding. It makes use of the fact that frogs vary among themselves, and those variations tend to be inherited, that is, passed on from parent to child via the genes. Simply by choosing which frogs breed and which do not, we can make a new kind of frog. Simple, isn't it?
But just making legs longer is not very impressive. After all, we started with frogs. They were just short-legged frogs. Suppose you started not with a shorter-legged form of frog, but with something that wasn't a frog at all, say something more like a newt. Newts have very short legs compared with frogs' legs, compared with frogs' hind legs at least, and they use them not for jumping, but for walking. Newts also have long tails, whereas frogs don't have tails at all. And newts are altogether longer and narrower than most frogs. But you can see that given enough thousands of generations, you could change a population of newts into a population of frogs simply by patiently choosing, in each of those millions of generations, male and female newts that were slightly more frog-like and letting them mate together while preventing their less frog-like friends from doing so. At no stage during the process would you see any dramatic change. Every generation would look pretty much like the previous generation, but nevertheless, once enough generations had gone by, you'd start to notice that the average tail length was slightly shorter and the average pair of hind legs was slightly longer. After a very large number of generations, the longer-legged, shorter-tailed individuals might find it easier to start using their long legs for hopping instead of crawling, and so on. Of course, in the scenario we've just described, we are imagining ourselves as breeders, picking out those males and females that we want to mate together in order to achieve an end result that we have chosen. Farmers have been applying this technique for thousands of years to produce cattle and crops that have higher yields or are more resistant to disease and so on. Darwin was the first person to understand that it works even when there is no breeder to do the choosing. Darwin saw that the whole thing would happen naturally, as a matter of course, for the simple reason that some individuals survive long enough to breed and others don't, and those that survive do so because they are better equipped than others. So the survivor's children inherit the genes that helped their parents to survive. Whether it's newts or frogs, hedgehogs or dandelions, there will always be some individuals that are better at surviving than others. If long legs happen to be helpful, for frogs or grasshoppers jumping out of danger, say, or for cheetahs hunting gazelles or gazelles fleeing from cheetahs, the individuals with longer legs will be less likely to die. They will be more likely to live long enough to reproduce. Also, more of the individuals available for mating with will have long legs. So in every generation, there will be a greater chance of the genes for longer legs being passed into the next generation. Over time, we will find that more and more of the individuals within that population have the genes for longer legs. So the effect will be exactly the same as if an intelligent designer, such as a human breeder, had chosen long-legged individuals for breeding. Except that no such designer is required. It all happens naturally, all by itself, as the automatic consequence of which individuals survive long enough to reproduce and which don't. For this reason, the process is called natural selection. Given enough generations, ancestors that look like newts can change into descendants that look like frogs. Given even more generations, ancestors that look like fish can change into descendants that look like monkeys. Given yet more generations, ancestors that look like bacteria can change into descendants that look like humans. And this is exactly what happened. This is the kind of thing that happened in the history of every animal and plant that has ever lived. The number of generations required is larger than you or I can possibly imagine, but the world is thousands of millions of years old and we know from fossils that life got started more than 3.5 billion years ago, so there has been plenty of time for evolution to happen.
This is Darwin's great idea, and it is called evolution by natural selection. It is one of the most important ideas ever to occur to a human mind. It explains everything we know about life on Earth. Because it is so important, I'll come back to it in later chapters. For now, it's enough to understand that evolution is very slow and gradual. In fact, it is the gradualness of evolution that allows it to make complicated things like frogs and princes. The magical changing of a frog into a prince would be not gradual but sudden, and this is what rules such things out of the world of reality. Evolution is a real explanation, which really works, and has real evidence to demonstrate the truth of it. Anything that suggests that complicated life forms appeared suddenly in one go, rather than evolving gradually step by step, is just a lazy story, no better than the fictional magic of a fairy godmother's wand. As for pumpkins turning into coaches, magic spells are just as certainly ruled out for them as they are for frogs and princes. Coaches don't evolve, or at least not naturally, in the same way that frogs and princes do. But coaches, along with airliners and pickaxes, computers and flint arrowheads, are made by humans who did evolve. Human brains and human hands evolve by natural selection just as surely as newts' tails and frogs' legs did. And human brains, once they had evolved, were able to design and create coaches and cars, scissors and symphonies, washing machines and watches. Once again, no magic. Once again, no trickery. Once again, everything beautifully and simply explained. In the rest of this book, I want to show you that the real world, as understood scientifically, has magic of its own, the kind I call poetic magic, an inspiring beauty which is all the more magical because it is real and because we can understand how it works. Next to the true beauty and magic of the real world, supernatural spells and stage tricks seem cheap and tawdry by comparison. The magic of reality is neither supernatural nor a trick, but, quite simply, wonderful. Wonderful and real. Wonderful because real.
Chapter 2. Who was the first person?
Most chapters in this book are headed by a question. My purpose is to answer the question, or at least give the best possible answer, which is the answer of science. But we shall usually begin with some mythical answers, because they're colourful and interesting, and real people have believed them. Some people still do.
All peoples around the world have origin myths to account for where they came from. Many tribal origin myths talk only about that one particular tribe, as though other tribes don't count. In the same way, many tribes have a rule they mustn't kill people, but people turns out to mean only others of your own tribe. Killing members of other tribes is just fine. Here's a typical origin myth from a group of Tasmanian Aborigines. A god called Moini was defeated by a rival god called Dromedina in a terrible battle up in the stars. Moini fell out of the stars down to Tasmania to die. Before he died, he wanted to give a last blessing to his final resting place, so he decided to create humans. But he was in such a hurry, knowing he was dying, that he forgot to give them knees. And no doubt distracted by his plight, he absent-mindedly gave them big tails like kangaroos, which meant they couldn't sit down. Then he died. The people hated having kangaroo tails and no knees, and they cried out to the heavens for help. The mighty Dromedina, who was still roaring around the sky on his victory parade, heard their cry and came down to Tasmania to see what the matter was. He took pity on the people, gave them bendable knees, and cut off their inconvenient kangaroo tails so they could all sit down at last. And they lived happily ever after. Quite often we meet different versions of the same myth. That's not surprising because people often change details while telling tales around the campfire, so local versions of the stories drift apart. In a different telling of this Tasmanian myth, Moini created the first man, called Parlevar, up in the sky. Parlevar couldn't sit down because he had a tail like a kangaroo and unbendable knees. As before, the rival star god Dromedina came to the rescue. He gave Parlivar proper knees and cut off his tail, healing the wound with grease. Parlivar then came down to Tasmania, walking along the sky road, the Milky Way. The Hebrew tribes of the Middle East had only a single god, whom they regarded as superior to the gods of rival tribes. He had various names, none of which they were allowed to say. He made the first man out of dust and called him Adam, which just means man. He deliberately made Adam like himself. Indeed, most of the gods of history were portrayed as men or sometimes women, often of giant size and always with supernatural powers. The god placed Adam in a beautiful garden called Eden, filled with trees whose fruit Adam was encouraged to eat, with one exception. This forbidden tree was the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and the god left Adam in no doubt that he must never eat its fruit. The god then realized that Adam might be lonely all by himself and wanted to do something about it. At this point, as with the story of Dromedina and Moini, there are two versions of the myth, both found in the biblical book of Genesis. In the more colourful version, the god made all the animals as Adam's helpers, then decided that there was still something missing, a woman. So he gave Adam a general anaesthetic, cut him open, removed one rib, and stitched him up again. Then he grew a woman from the rib, rather as you grow a flower from a cutting. He named her Eve and presented her to Adam as his wife. Unfortunately, there was a wicked snake in the garden who approached Eve and persuaded her to give Adam the forbidden fruit from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Adam and Eve ate the fruit and promptly acquired the knowledge that they were naked. This embarrassed them, and they made themselves aprons out of fig leaves. When the god noticed this, he was furious with them for eating the fruit and acquiring knowledge, losing their innocence, I suppose. He threw them out of the garden and condemned them and all their descendants to a life of hardship and pain. To this day, the story of Adam's and Eve's terrible disobedience is still taken seriously by many people under the name of original sin. Some people even believe we've all inherited this original sin from Adam and share in his guilt, although many of them admit that Adam never actually existed. The Norse peoples of Scandinavia, famous as Viking seafarers, had lots of gods, as the Greeks and Romans did. The name of their chief god was Odin, sometimes called Votan or Woden, from which we get our Wednesday. Thursday comes from another Norse god, Thor, the god of thunder, which he made with his mighty hammer. One day, Odin was walking along the seashore with his brothers, who were also gods, and they came upon two tree trunks. One of these tree trunks they turned into the first man, whom they called Ask, and the other they turned into the first woman, naming her Embla. Having created the bodies of the first man and first woman, the brother gods then gave them the breath of life, followed by consciousness, faces, and the gift of speech. Why tree trunks, I wonder? Why not icicles or sand dunes? Isn't it fascinating to wonder who made such stories up and why? Presumably the original inventors of all these myths knew they were fiction at the moment when they made them up. Or do you think many different people came up with different parts of the stories at different times and in different places, and other people later put them together, perhaps changing some of them, without realizing that the various bits were originally just made up? Stories are fun, and we all love repeating them. But when we hear a colourful story, whether it's an ancient myth or a modern urban legend whizzing around the internet, it's also worth stopping to ask whether it, or any part of it, is true.
So let's ask ourselves that question, who was the first person, and take a look at the true scientific answer. Who was the first person really? This may surprise you, but there never was a first person, because every person had to have parents, and those parents had to be people too. Same with rabbits. There never was a first rabbit, never was a first crocodile, never a first dragonfly. Every creature ever born belong to the same species as its parents, with perhaps a very small number of exceptions which I shall ignore here. So that must mean that every creature ever born belonged to the same species as its grandparents, and its great-grandparents, and its great-great-grandparents, and so on forever. Forever? Well, no, it's not as simple as that. This is going to need a bit of explaining, and I'll begin with a thought experiment. A thought experiment is an experiment in your imagination. What we are going to imagine is not literally possible because it takes us way, way back in time, long before we were born. But imagining it teaches us something important. So here is our thought experiment. All you have to do is imagine yourself following these instructions. Find a picture of yourself. Now take a picture of your father and place it on top. Then find a picture of his father, your grandfather. Then place on top of that a picture of your grandfather's father, your great-grandfather. You may not have ever met any of your great-grandfathers. I never met any of mine, but I know that one was a country schoolmaster, one a country doctor, one a forester in British India, and one a lawyer, greedy for cream, who died rock-climbing in old age. Still, even if you don't know what your father's father's father looked like, you can imagine him as a sort of shadowy figure, perhaps a fading brown photograph in a leather frame. Now do the same thing with his father, your great-great-grandfather, and just carry on piling the pictures on top of each other, going back through more and more and more great-great-greats. You can go on doing this even before photography was invented. This is a thought experiment, after all. How many greats do we need for our thought experiment? Oh, a mere 185 million or so will do nicely. Mere? Mere? It isn't easy to imagine a pile of 185 million pictures. How high would it be? Well, if each picture was printed as a normal picture postcard, 185 million pictures would form a tower about 16,000 feet high. That's more than 40 New York skyscrapers standing on top of each other. Too tall to climb, even if it didn't fall over, which it would. So let's tip it safely on its side and pack the pictures along the length of a single bookshelf. How long is the bookshelf? About 3 miles. The near end of the bookshelf has the picture of you, the far end has a picture of your 185 million greats grandfather. What did he look like? An old man with wispy hair and white side whiskers? A caveman in a leopard skin? Forget any such thought. We don't know exactly what he looked like, but fossils give us a pretty good idea. Believe it or not, your 185 million greats-grandfather was a fish. So was your 185 million greats-grandmother, which is just as well, or they couldn't have mated with each other, and you wouldn't be here. Let's now walk along our 3-mile bookshelf, pulling pictures off it one by one to have a look at them. Every picture shows a creature belonging to the same species as the picture on either side of it. Every one looks just like its neighbours in the line, or at least as much alike as any man looks like his father and his son. Yet, if you walk steadily from one end of the bookshelf to the other, you'll see a human at one end and a fish at the other, and lots of other interesting great-great-great-great-grandparents in between, which, as we shall soon see, include some animals that look like apes, others that look like monkeys, others that look like shrews, and so on. Each one is like its neighbours in the line, yet if you pick any two pictures far apart in the line, they are very different, and if you follow the line from humans back far enough, you come to a fish. How can this be? Actually, it isn't all that difficult to understand. We're quite used to gradual changes that step by step, one after the other, make up a big change. You were once a baby, now you are not. When you are a lot older, you look quite different again. Yet every day of your life when you wake up, you are the same person as when you went to bed the previous night. A baby changes into a toddler, then into a child, then into an adolescent, then a young adult, then a middle-aged adult, then an old person. And the change happens so gradually that there never is a day when you can say, this person has suddenly stopped being a baby and become a toddler. And later on, there never comes a day when you can say, this person has stopped being a child and become an adolescent. There's never a day when you can say, yesterday this man was middle-aged, today he is old. That helps us to understand our thought experiment, which takes us back through 185 million generations of parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, until we come face to face with a fish. And turning round to go forwards in time, it's what happened when your fish ancestor had a fishy child who had a fishy child who had a child who, 185 million, gradually less fishy generations later, turned out to be you.
So it was all very gradual, so gradual that you wouldn't notice any change as you walked back 1,000 years, or even 10,000 years, which would bring you to somewhere around your 400 greats-grandfather. Or rather, you would notice lots of little changes all the way along, because nobody looks exactly like their father. But you wouldn't notice any general trend. 10,000 years back from modern humans is not long enough to show a trend. The portrait of your ancestor of 10,000 years ago would be no different from modern people, if we set aside superficial differences in dress and hair and whisker style. He would be no more different from us than modern people are different from other modern people. How about 100,000 years, where we might find your 4,000 greats-grandfather? Well, now maybe there would be a just noticeable change. Perhaps a slight thickening of the skull, especially under the eyebrows, but it would still only be slight. Now let's push a bit further back in time. If you walked the first 1,000,000 years along the shelf, the picture of your 50,000 greats-grandfather would be different enough to count as a different species, the one we call Homo erectus. We today, as you know, are Homo sapiens. Homo erectus and Homo sapiens probably wouldn't have been able to mate with each other, or even, if they could, the baby would probably not have been able to have babies of its own, in the same way that a mule, which has a donkey father and a horse mother, is almost always unable to have offspring. We'll see why in the next chapter. Once again, though, everything is gradual. You are Homo sapiens, and your 50,000 greats-grandfather was Homo erectus. But there never was a Homo erectus who suddenly gave birth to a Homo sapiens baby. So the question of who was the first person and when they lived doesn't have a precise answer. It's kind of fuzzy, like the answer to the question, when did you stop being a baby and become a toddler? At some point, probably less than 1,000,000 years ago, but more than 100,000 years ago, our ancestors were sufficiently different from us that a modern person wouldn't have been able to breed with them if they had met. Whether we should call Homo erectus a person, a human, is a different question. That's a question about how you choose to use words, what's called a semantic question. Some people might want to call a zebra a stripy horse, but others might like to keep the word horse for the species that we ride. That's another semantic question. You might prefer to keep the words person, man, and woman for Homo sapiens. That's up to you. Nobody, however, would want to call your fishy 185 million greats-grandfather a man. That would be just silly, even though there is a continuous chain linking him to you, every link in the chain being a member of exactly the same species as its neighbours in the chain.
Turn to stone. Now, how do we know what our distant ancestors looked like, and how do we know when they lived? Mostly from fossils. Fossils are made of stone. They are stones that have picked up the shape of dead animals or plants. The great majority of animals die with no hope of turning into a fossil. The trick, if you want to be a fossil, is to get yourself buried in the right kind of mud or silt, the kind that might eventually harden to form sedimentary rock. What does that mean? Rocks are of three kinds: igneous, sedimentary, and metamorphic. I shall ignore metamorphic rocks, as they were originally one of the other two kinds, igneous or sedimentary, and have been changed by pressure and/or heat. Igneous rocks, from the Latin for fire, ignis, were once molten, like the hot lava that comes out of erupting volcanoes now, and solidified into hard rock when they cooled. Hard rocks of any kind get worn down, eroded, by wind or water to make smaller rocks, pebbles, sand, and dust. Sand or dust gets suspended in water and can then settle in layers of sediment or mud at the bottom of a sea, lake, or river. Over a very long time, sediments can harden to make layers or strata of sedimentary rock. Although all strata start off flat and horizontal, they have often got tilted, upended, or warped by the time we see them millions of years later. We'll see how this happens in Chapter 10 on earthquakes. Now suppose a dead animal happens to get washed into the mud, in an estuary perhaps. If the mud later hardens to become sedimentary rock, the animal's body may rot away, leaving in the hardening rock a hollow imprint of its form, which we eventually find. That's one kind of fossil, a kind of negative picture of the animal. Or the hollow imprint may act as a mould into which new sediments fall, later hardening to form a positive replica of the outside of the animal's body. That's a second kind of fossil. And there's a third kind of fossil in which the atoms and molecules of the animal's body are, one by one, replaced by atoms and molecules of minerals from the water, which later crystallize to form rock. This is the best kind of fossil because, with luck, tiny details of the animal's insides are permanently reproduced right through the middle of the fossil.
Fossils can even be dated. We can tell how old they are, mostly by measuring radioactive isotopes in the rocks. We'll learn what isotopes are and atoms in Chapter 4. Briefly, a radioactive isotope is a kind of atom which decays into a different kind of atom. For example, one called uranium-238 turns into one called lead-206. Because we know how long this takes to happen, we can think of the isotope as a radioactive clock. Radioactive clocks are rather like the water clocks and candle clocks that people used in the days before pendulum clocks were invented. A tank of water with a hole in the bottom will drain at a measurable rate. If the tank was filled at dawn, you can tell how much of the day has passed by measuring the present level of water. Same with a candle clock. The candle burns at a fixed rate, so you can tell how long it has been burning by measuring how much candle is left. In the case of a uranium-238 clock, we know that it takes 4.5 billion years for half the uranium-238 to decay to lead-206. This is called the half-life of uranium-238. So by measuring how much lead-206 there is in a rock, compared with the amount of uranium-238, you can calculate how long it is since there was no lead-206 and only uranium-238. How long, in other words, since the clock was zeroed. And when is the clock zeroed? Well, it only happens with igneous rocks, whose clocks are all zeroed at the moment when the molten rock hardens to become solid. It doesn't work with sedimentary rock, which has no such zero moment, and this is a pity because fossils are found only in sedimentary rocks. So we have to find igneous rocks close by sedimentary layers and use them as our clocks. For example, if a fossil is in a sediment with a 120-million-year-old igneous rock above it and a 130-million-year-old igneous rock below it, you know the fossil dates from somewhere between 120 million and 130 million years ago. That's how all the dates mentioned in this chapter are arrived at. They are all approximate dates, not to be taken as too precise. Uranium-238 is not the only radioactive isotope we can use as a clock. There are plenty of others with a wonderfully wide spread of half-lives. For example, carbon-14 has a half-life of only 5,730 years, which makes it useful for archaeologists looking at human history. It is a beautiful fact that many of the different radioactive clocks have overlapping timescales, so we can use them to check up on each other. And they always agree. The carbon-14 clock works in a different way from the others. It doesn't involve igneous rocks, but uses the remains of living bodies themselves, for example, old wood. It is one of the fastest of our radioactive clocks, but 5,730 years is still much longer than a human lifetime, so you might ask how we know it is the half-life of carbon-14, let alone how we know that 4.5 billion years is the half-life of uranium-238. The answer is easy. We don't have to wait for half of the atoms to decay. We can measure the rate of decay of only a tiny fraction of the atoms and work out the half-life, quarter-life, hundredth life, etc., from that.
A ride back in time. Let's do another thought experiment. Take a few companions and get in a time machine. Fire up the engine and zoom back 10,000 years. Open the door and have a look at the people you meet. If you happen to land in what is now Iraq, they'll be in the process of inventing agriculture. In most other places, there'll be hunter-gatherers moving from place to place, hunting wild animals and gathering wild berries, nuts and roots. You won't be able to understand what they say, and they'll be wearing very different clothes, if any. Nevertheless, if you dress them in modern clothes and give them modern haircuts, they'll be indistinguishable from modern people, or no more different from some modern people than people are different from one another today. And they'll be fully capable of breeding with any of the modern people on board your time machine. Now take one volunteer from among them, perhaps your 400 great-grandfather, because this is approximately the time when he might have lived, and set off again in your time machine back another 10,000 years, to 20,000 years ago, where you have a chance to meet your 800 great-grandparents. This time the people you see will all be hunter-gatherers, but once again their bodies will be those of fully modern humans, and once again they'll be perfectly capable of interbreeding with modern people and producing fertile offspring. Take one of them with you in the time machine and set off another 10,000 years into the past. Keep on doing this, hopping back in steps of 10,000 years, at each stop picking up a new passenger and taking him or her back to the past. The point is that eventually, after a lot of 10,000-year hops, perhaps when you've gone a million years into the past, you'll begin to notice that the people you meet when you emerge from the time machine are definitely different from us and can't interbreed with those of us who boarded with you at the start of its journey. But they will be capable of breeding with the latest additions to the passenger list, who are almost as ancient as they are themselves. I'm just making the same point as I made before, about gradual change being imperceptible, like the moving hour hand of a watch, but using a different thought experiment. It's worth saying in two different ways, because it is so important and yet, quite understandably, so hard for some people to appreciate. Let's resume our journey into the past and look at some of the stations on the way back to that beautiful fish. Suppose we've just arrived in our time machine at the station labelled 6 million years ago. What shall we find there? So long as we make a point of being in Africa, we'll find our 250,000 great-grandparent, give or take some generations. They'll be apes, and they might look a bit like chimpanzees. But they won't be chimpanzees. Instead, they'll be the ancestors that we share with chimpanzees. They'll be too different from us to mate with us, and too different from chimpanzees to mate with chimpanzees. But they will be able to mate with the passengers we took on board at station 5,990,000 years ago, and probably those from station 5,900,000 years ago too, but probably not those who joined us at station 4 million years ago. Let's now resume our 10,000-year hops all the way back to station 25 million years ago. There we shall find your and my 1.5 million great-grandparents at an approximate estimate. They will not be apes, for they will have tails. We would call them monkeys if we met them today, although they are no more closely related to modern monkeys than they are to us. Although very different from us and incapable of breeding with us or with modern monkeys, they will breed happily with the all but identical passengers who joined us at station 24,990,000 years ago. Gradual, gradual change all the way. On we go, back and back, 10,000 years at a time, finding no noticeable change at each stop. Let's pause to see who greets us when we reach station 63 million years ago. Here we can shake hands, or should that be pause, with our 7 million great-grandparents. They look something like lemurs or bush babies, and they are indeed the ancestors of all modern lemurs and bush babies, as well as the ancestors of all modern monkeys and apes, including us. They are as closely related to modern humans as they are to modern monkeys, and no more closely to modern lemurs or bush babies. They wouldn't be able to mate with any modern animals, but they would probably be able to mate with the passengers we picked up at station 62,990,000 years ago. Let's welcome them aboard the time machine and speed on backwards. At station 105 million years ago, we'll meet our 45 million great-grandfather. He's also the grand ancestor of all the modern mammals except marsupials, now found mostly in Australia, plus a few in America, and monotremes, duck-billed platypuses and spiny anteaters, now found only in Australia, New Guinea. He's equally closely related to all modern mammals, although he may look a bit more like some of them than others. Station 310 million years ago presents us with our 170 million great-grandmother. She's the grand ancestor of all modern mammals, all modern reptiles, snakes, lizards, turtles, crocodiles, and all dinosaurs, including birds, because birds arose from within the dinosaurs. She is equally distantly related to all those modern animals, although she looks more like a lizard. What that means is that lizards have changed less since her time than, say, mammals have. Seasoned time travellers as we are by now, it isn't far to go until we hit the fish that I mentioned earlier. Let's make one more stop on the way, at station 340 million years ago, where we meet our 175 million great-grandfather. He looks a bit like a newt, and is the grand ancestor of all modern amphibians, newts and frogs, as well as of all the other land vertebrates. And so to station 417 million years ago, and your 185 million great-grandfather, the fish that we met before. From there we could go on even further back in time, meeting more and more distant great-grandparents, including various kinds of fish with jaws, then fish without jaws, then our knowledge starts to fade into a kind of mist of uncertainty, for these very ancient times are where we start to run out of fossils.
DNA tells us we are all cousins. Although we may lack the fossils to tell us exactly what our very ancient ancestors looked like, we are in no doubt at all that all living creatures are our cousins and cousins of each other. And we also know which modern animals are close cousins of each other, like humans and chimpanzees, or rats and mice, and which are distant cousins of each other, like humans and cuckoos, or mice and alligators. How do we know? By systematically comparing them. Nowadays, the most powerful evidence comes from comparing their DNA. DNA is the genetic information that all living creatures carry in each of their cells. The DNA is spelled out along massively coiled tapes of data called chromosomes. These chromosomes really are very like the kind of data tapes you'd feed into an old-fashioned computer, because the information they carry is digital and is strung along them in order. They consist of long strings of code letters, which you can count. Each letter is either there or it isn't. There are no half measures. That's what makes it digital, and why we say DNA is spelled out. All genes in every animal, plant, and bacterium that has ever been looked at are coded messages for how to build the creature, written in a standard alphabet. The alphabet has only 4 letters to choose from, as opposed to the 26 letters of the English alphabet. We write the DNA letters as A, T, C, and G. The same genes occur in many different creatures, with a few revealing differences. For example, there's a gene called FOXP2, which is shared by all mammals and lots more creatures besides. The gene is a string of more than 2,000 letters. You can tell that FOXP2 is the same gene in all mammals because the great majority of the code letters are the same. Not quite all the chimpanzee letters are the same as ours, and somewhat fewer of the mouse ones are. Of the total of 2,076 letters in FOXP2, the chimpanzee has 9 letters different from ours, while the mouse has 139 letters different. And that pattern holds for other genes too. That explains why chimpanzees are very like us, while mice are less so. Chimpanzees are our close cousins. Mice are our more distant cousins. Distant cousins means that the most recent ancestor we share with them lived a long time ago. Monkeys are closer to us than mice, but further from us than chimpanzees. Baboons and rhesus macaques are both monkeys, close cousins of each other, and with almost identical FOXP2 genes. They are exactly as distant from chimps as they are from us. And the number of DNA letters in FOXP2 that separate baboons from chimps is almost exactly the same, 24, as the number of letters that separate baboons from us, 23. It all fits. And just to finish off this little thought, frogs are much more distant cousins of all mammals. All mammals have approximately the same number of letter differences from a frog for the simple reason that they are all exactly equally close cousins. All mammals share a more recent ancestor with each other, about 180 million years ago, than they do with the frog, about 340 million years ago. But of course not all humans are the same as all other humans, and not all baboons are the same as all other baboons, and not all mice are the same as all other mice. We could compare your genes with mine letter by letter, and the result? We'd turn out to have even more letters in common than either of us does with a chimpanzee. But we'd still find some letters that are different. Not many, and there's no particular reason to single out the FOXP2 gene. But if you counted up the number of letters all humans share in all our genes, it would be more than any of us shares with a chimpanzee. And you share more letters with your cousin than you share with me. And you share even more letters with your mother and your father, and if you have one, with your sister or brother. In fact, you can work out how closely related any two people are to each other by counting the number of DNA letters they share. It's an interesting count to make, and it is something we are probably going to hear more about in the future. For example, the police will be able to track somebody down if they have the DNA fingerprint of his brother. Some genes are recognizably the same, with minor differences, in all mammals. Counting the number of letter differences in such genes is useful for working out how closely related different mammal species are. Other genes are useful for working out more distant relationships, for example, between vertebrates and worms. Other genes, again, are useful for working out relationships within a species, say for working out how closely related you are to me. In case you're interested, if you happen to come from England, our most recent shared ancestor probably lived only a few centuries back. If you happen to be a native Tasmanian or a Native American, we'd have to go back some tens of thousands of years to find a shared ancestor. If you happen to be a Kung San of the Kalahari Desert, we might have to go back even further.
Chapter 3. Why are there so many different kinds of animals? There are lots of myths that attempt to explain why particular kinds of animals are the way that they are. Myths that explain things like why leopards have spots and why rabbits have white tails. But there don't seem to be many myths about the sheer range and variety of different kinds of animals. I can find nothing akin to the Jewish myth of the Tower of Babel, which accounts for the great variety of languages. Once upon a time, according to this myth, all the people in the world spoke the same language. They could therefore work harmoniously together to build a great tower, which they hoped would reach the sky. God noticed this and took a very dim view of everybody being able to understand everybody else. Whatever might they get up to next, if they could talk to each other and work together? So he decided to confound their language, so that they may not understand one another's speech. This, the myth tells us, is why there are so many different languages, and why, when people try to talk to people from another tribe or country, their speech often sounds like meaningless babble. Oddly enough, there is no connection between the word Babel and the Tower of Babel. I was hoping to find a similar myth about the great diversity of animals, because there is a resemblance between language evolution and animal evolution, as we shall see. But there doesn't seem to be any myth that specifically tackles the sheer number of different kinds of animals. This is surprising because there is indirect evidence that tribal peoples can be well aware of the fact that there are many different kinds of animals. In the 1920s, a now famous German scientist called Ernst Mayr did a pioneering study of the birds of the New Guinea Highlands. He compiled a list of 137 species, then discovered, to his amazement, that the local Papuan tribesmen had separate names for 136 of them.
Back to the myths. The Hopi tribe of North America had a goddess called Spider Woman. In their creation myth, she teamed up with Tawa, the sun god, and they sang the first magic song as a duet. This song brought the earth and life into being. Spider-Woman then took the threads of Tawa's thoughts and wove them into solid form, creating fish, birds, and all other animals. Other North American tribes, the Pueblo and Navajo peoples, have a myth of life that is a tiny bit like the idea of evolution. Life emerges from the earth like a sprouting plant, growing up through a sequence of stages. The insects climbed from their world, the first or red world, up into the second world, the blue world, where the birds lived. The second world then became too crowded, so the birds and insects flew up into the third or yellow world, where the people and other mammals lived. The yellow world in turn became crowded and food became scarce, so they all, insects, birds and everybody, went up to the fourth world, the black and white world of day and night. Here the gods had already created cleverer people who knew how to farm the fourth world and who taught the newcomers how to do it too. The Jewish creation myth comes closer to doing justice to diversity, but it doesn't really attempt to explain it. Actually, the Jewish holy book has two different creation myths, as we saw in the previous chapter. In the first one, the Jewish God created everything in 6 days. On the fifth day, he created fish, whales and all sea creatures, and the birds of the air. On the sixth day, he made the rest of the land animals, including man. The language of the myth pays some attention to the number and variety of living creatures. For example, God created great whales and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind, and made every beast of the earth and everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind. But why was there such variety? We are not told. In the second myth, we get some hint that the god might have thought his first man needed a variety of companions. Adam, the first man, is created alone and placed in the beautiful oasis garden. But then the god realized that it is not good that the man should be alone, and he therefore formed every beast of the field and every fowl of the air and brought them unto Adam to see what he would call them.
Why are there really so many different kinds of animals? Adam's task of naming all the animals was a tough one, tougher than the ancient Hebrews could possibly have realized. It's been estimated that about 2 million species have so far been given scientific names, and even these are just a small fraction of the number of species yet to be named. How do we even decide whether two animals belong in the same species or in two different species? Where animals reproduce sexually, we can come up with a sort of definition. Animals belong to different species if they don't breed together. There are borderline cases like horses and donkeys, which can breed together but produce offspring, called mules or hinnies, that are infertile, that is, that cannot have offspring themselves. We therefore place a horse and a donkey in different species. More obviously, horses and dogs belong to different species because they don't even try to interbreed and couldn't produce offspring if they did, even infertile ones. But spaniels and poodles belong to the same species because they happily interbreed, and the puppies that they produce are fertile. Every scientific name of an animal or plant consists of two Latin words, usually printed in italics. The first word refers to the genus or group of species, and the second to the individual species within the genus. Homo sapiens, wise man, and Elephas maximus, very big elephant, are examples. Every species is a member of a genus. Homo is a genus, so is Elephas. The lion is Panthera leo, and the genus Panthera also includes Panthera tigris, tiger, Panthera pardus, leopard or panther, and Panthera onca, jaguar. Homo sapiens is the only surviving species of our genus, but fossils have been given names like Homo erectus and Homo habilis. Other human-like fossils are sufficiently different from Homo to be placed in a different genus, for example, Australopithecus africanus and Australopithecus afarensis. Nothing to do with Australia, by the way. Australo just means southern, which is where Australia's name also comes from. Each genus belongs to a family, usually printed in ordinary Roman type with a capital initial. Cats, including lions, leopards, cheetahs, lynxes, and lots of smaller cats, make up the family Felidae. Every family belongs to an order. Cats, dogs, bears, weasels, and hyenas belong to different families within the order Carnivora. Monkeys, apes, including us, and lemurs all belong to different families within the order Primates. And every order belongs to a class. All mammals are in the class Mammalia. Can you see the shape of a tree developing in your mind as you hear this description of the sequence of groupings? It is a family tree, a tree with many branches, each branch having sub-branches, and each sub-branch having sub-sub-branches. The tips of the twigs are species. The other groupings, class, order, family, genus, are the branches and sub-branches. The whole tree is all of life on Earth. Think about why trees have so many twigs. Branches branch. When we have enough branches of branches of branches, the total number of twigs can be very large. That's what happens in evolution. Charles Darwin himself drew a branching tree as the only picture in his most famous book, On the Origin of Species. He sketched an early version in one of his notebooks some years earlier. At the top of the page, he wrote a mysterious little message to himself. I think. What do you think he meant? Maybe he started to write a sentence and one of his children interrupted him, so he never finished it. Maybe he found it easier to represent quickly what he was thinking in this diagram than in words. Perhaps we shall never know. There is other handwriting on the page, but it is hard to decipher. It is tantalizing to read the actual notes of a great scientist written on a particular day and never meant for publication. The following isn't exactly how the tree of animals branched, but it gives you an idea of the principle. Imagine an ancestral species splitting into two species. If each of those then splits into two, that makes four. If each of them splits into two, that makes eight, and so on through 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512. You can see that if you carry on doubling up, it doesn't take long to get up into the millions of species. That probably makes sense to you, but you may be wondering why a species should split. Well, it's for pretty much the same reason as human languages split. So let's pause to think about that for a moment.
Pulling apart how languages and species divide. Although the legend of the Tower of Babel is, of course, not really true, it does raise the interesting question of why there are so many different languages. Just as some species are more similar than others and are placed in the same family, so there are also families of languages. Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, French, and many European languages and dialects, such as Romance, Galician, Occitan, and Catalan, are all pretty similar to each other. Together, they're called Romance languages. The name actually comes from their common origin in Latin, the language of Rome, not from any association with romance. But let's use an expression of love as our example. Depending on which country you are in, you might declare your feelings in one of the following ways. Ti amo, amo te, t'aimi, or je t'aime. In Latin it would be te amo, exactly like modern Spanish.
To swear your love to someone in Kenya, Tanzania, or Uganda, you could say in Swahili, nakupenda. A bit further south in Mozambique, Zambia, or Malawi, where I was brought up, you might say in the Chinyanja language, ndimakukonda. In other so-called Bantu languages in southern Africa, you might say ndinokuda, ndiyakuthanda, or to a Zulu, ngiyakuthanda. This Bantu family of languages is quite distinct from the Romance family of languages, and both are distinct from the Germanic family, which includes Dutch, German, and the Scandinavian languages. See how we use the word family for languages, just as we do for species, the cat family, the dog family, and also, of course, for our own families, the Jones family, the Robinson family, the Dawkins family.
It isn't hard to work out how families of related languages arise over the centuries. Listen to the way you and your friends speak to each other and compare it to the way your grandparents speak. Their speech is only slightly different, and you can easily understand them, but they are only two generations away. Now imagine talking not to your grandparents, but to your 25 great-grandparents. If you happen to be English, that might take you back to the late 14th century, the lifetime of the poet Geoffrey Chaucer, who wrote descriptions like this.
He was a lord full fat and en gode point, his een steeper and rolling in his head, that stemmed as a fornice of a lead. His boat as souple, his horse in great estart, no certainly he was a fire prelate. He was not pale as is a fourpin ghost. A fat swan loved he best of any roast. His palfrey was as brown as is a berrye.
Well, it is recognisably English, isn't it? But if it were any more different, you'd probably consider it a separate language, as different as Spanish is from Italian. So the language in any one place changes century by century. We could say it drifts into something different. Now add the fact that people speaking the same language in different places don't often have the opportunity to hear each other, or at least they didn't before telephones and radios were invented, and the fact that language drifts in different directions in different places. This applies to the way it is spoken as well as to the words themselves. Think how different English sounds in a Scottish, Welsh, Geordie, Cornish, Australian or American accent. And Scottish people can easily distinguish an Edinburgh accent from a Glasgow accent or a Hebridean accent. Over time, both the way the language is spoken and the words used become characteristic of a region. When two ways of speaking a language have drifted sufficiently far apart, we call them different dialects. After enough centuries of drift, different regional dialects eventually become so different that people in one region can no longer understand people in another. At this point, we call them separate languages. That is what happened when German and Dutch drifted in separate directions from a now extinct ancestral language. It is what happened when French, Italian, Spanish, and Portuguese independently drifted away from Latin in separate parts of Europe. You can draw a family tree of languages with cousins like French, Portuguese, and Italian on neighbouring branches, and ancestors like Latin further down the tree, just as Darwin did with species. Like languages, species change over time and over distance. Before we look at why this happens, we need to see how they do it. For species, the equivalent of words is DNA, the genetic information every living thing carries inside it that determines how it is made, as we saw in Chapter 2. When individuals reproduce sexually, they mix their DNA. And when members of one local population migrate into another local population and introduce their genes into it by mating with individuals of the population they've just joined, we call this gene flow. The equivalent of, say, Italian and French drifting apart is that the DNA of two separated populations of a species become less and less alike over time. Their DNA becomes less and less able to work together to make babies. Horses and donkeys can mate with each other, but horse DNA has drifted so far from donkey DNA that the two can no longer understand each other. Or rather, they can mix well enough, the two DNA dialects can understand each other well enough, to make a living creature, a mule, but not well enough to make one that can reproduce itself. Mules, as we saw earlier, are sterile. An important difference between species and languages is that languages can pick up loan words from other languages. Long after it developed as a separate language from Romance, Germanic and Celtic sources, for example, English picked up shampoo from Hindi, iceberg from Norwegian, bungalow from Bengali and anorak from Inuit. Animal species, by contrast, never, or almost never, exchange DNA ever again once they've drifted far enough apart to have stopped breeding together. Bacteria are another story. They do exchange genes, but there isn't enough space in this book to go into that. In the rest of this chapter, assume that we are talking about animals.
Islands and isolation, the power of separation. So the DNA of species, like the words of languages, drifts apart when separated. Why might this happen? What might start the separation? An obvious possibility is the sea. Populations on separate islands don't meet each other, not often anyway, so their two sets of genes have the opportunity to drift away from one another. This makes islands extremely important in the origins of new species. But we can think of an island as more than just a piece of land surrounded by water. To a frog, an oasis is an island where it can live, surrounded by a desert where it can't. To a fish, a lake is an island. Islands matter, both for species and for languages, because the population of an island is cut off from contact with other populations, preventing gene flow in the case of species, just as it prevents language drift, and so is free to begin to evolve in its own direction. The next important point is that the population of an island need not be totally isolated forever. Genes can occasionally cross the barrier surrounding it, whether this be water or uninhabitable land. On the 4th of October 1995, a mat of logs and uprooted trees was blown onto a beach on the Caribbean island of Anguilla. On the mat were 15 green iguanas, alive after what must have been a perilous journey from another island, probably Guadeloupe, 160 miles away. Two hurricanes called Lewis and Marilyn had roared through the Caribbean during the previous month, uprooting trees and flinging them into the sea. It seems that one of these hurricanes must have torn down the trees in which the iguanas were climbing. They love sitting up trees, as I've seen in Panama, and blown them out to sea. Eventually reaching Anguilla, they crawled off their unorthodox means of transport onto the beach and began a new life, feeding and reproducing and passing on their DNA on a brand new island home. We know this happened because the iguanas were seen arriving on Anguilla by local fishermen. Centuries earlier, although nobody was there to witness it, something similar is almost certainly what brought the iguanas' ancestors to Guadeloupe in the first place, and something like the same story almost certainly accounts for the presence of iguanas on the Galapagos Islands, which is where we turn for the next step in our story. The Galapagos Islands are historically important because they probably inspired Charles Darwin's first thoughts on evolution when, as a member of the expedition on HMS Beagle, he visited them in 1835. They are a collection of volcanic islands in the Pacific Ocean near the equator, about 600 miles west of South America. They're all young, just a few million years old, formed by volcanoes punching up from the bottom of the sea. This means that all the species of animals and plants on the islands must have arrived from elsewhere, presumably the mainland of South America, and recently by evolutionary standards. Once arrived, species could make the shorter crossings from island to island, sufficiently often to reach all the islands, maybe once or twice every century or so, but sufficiently seldom that they were able to evolve separately, drift apart, as we've been saying in this chapter, during the intervals between the rare crossings. Nobody knows when the first iguanas arrived in the Galapagos. They probably rafted across from the mainland, just like the ones that arrived in Anguilla in 1995. Nowadays, the nearest island to the mainland is San Cristobal. Darwin knew it by the English name of Chatham. But millions of years ago, there were other islands too, which have now sunk beneath the sea. The iguanas could have arrived first on one of the now sunken islands, and then crossed to other islands, including those still above water today. Once there, they had the opportunity to flourish in a new place, just like the ones that arrived in Anguilla in 1995. The first iguanas on Galapagos would have evolved to become different from their cousins on the mainland, partly by just drifting, like languages, and partly because natural selection would have favoured new survival skills. A relatively barren volcanic island is a very different place from the South American mainland.
The distances between the different islands are much smaller than the distance from any of them to the mainland. so accidental sea crossings between islands would be relatively common, perhaps once per century, rather than once per millennium. And iguanas would have started turning up on most or all of the islands eventually. Island hoppings would have been rare enough to allow some evolutionary drifting apart on the different islands between contaminations of the genes by subsequent island hoppings, rare enough to allow them to evolve so much that when they eventually met again, they could no longer breed together. The result is that there are now three distinct species of land iguana on Galapagos, which are no longer capable of crossbreeding with each other. Conolophus pallidus is found only on the island of Santa Fe. Conolophus subcristatus lives on several islands, including Fernandina, Isabella, and Santa Cruz, each island population possibly on its way to becoming a separate species. Conolophus marthi is confined to the northernmost of the chain of five volcanoes on the Big Island of Isabella. That raises another interesting point, by the way. You remember we said that a lake or an oasis could count as an island, even though neither consists of land surrounded by water? Well, the same goes for each of the five volcanoes on Isabella. Each volcano in the chain is surrounded by a zone of rich vegetation, which is a kind of oasis separated from the next volcano by a desert. Most of the Galapagos Islands have only a single large volcano, but Isabella has five. If the sea level rises, perhaps because of global warming, Isabella could become five islands separated by sea. As it is, you can think of each volcano as a kind of island within an island. That's how it would seem to an animal like a land iguana or a giant tortoise, which needs to feed on the vegetation found only on the slopes around the volcanoes. Any kind of isolation by a geographical barrier, which can be crossed sometimes but not too often, leads to evolutionary branching. Actually, it doesn't have to be a geographical barrier. There are other possibilities, especially in insects, but for simplicity's sake, we won't go into them here. And once the divided populations have drifted far enough apart that they can no longer breed together, the geographical barrier is no longer necessary. The two species can go their separate evolutionary ways without contaminating each other's DNA ever again. It is mainly separations of this kind that were originally responsible for all the new species that have ever arisen on this planet. Even, as we shall see, the original separation of the ancestors of, say, snails from the ancestors of all vertebrates, including us.
At some point in the history of iguanas on Galapagos, a branching occurred which was to lead to a very peculiar new species. On one of the islands, we don't know which, a local population of land iguanas completely changed their way of life. Instead of eating land plants on the slopes of volcanoes, they went to the shore and took to feeding on seaweed. Natural selection then favoured those individuals that became skilled swimmers, until nowadays their descendants habitually dive to graze on underwater seaweeds. They're called marine iguanas, and unlike land iguanas, they are found nowhere but Galapagos. They have lots of strange features that equip them for life in the sea, and this makes them really rather different from the land iguanas of Galapagos and everywhere else in the world. They have certainly evolved from land iguanas, but they're not especially close cousins of today's land iguanas of Galapagos, so it is possible that they evolved from an earlier, now extinct genus, which colonized the islands from the mainland long before the present Conolophus. There are different races of marine iguanas, but not different species, on the different islands. One day, these different island races will probably be found to have drifted apart far enough to be called different species of the marine iguana genus. It's a similar story for giant tortoises, for lava lizards, for the strange flightless cormorants, for mockingbirds, for finches, and for many other animals and plants of Galapagos. And the same kind of thing happens all over the world. Galapagos is just a particularly clear example. Islands, including lakes, oases, and mountains, manufacture new species. A river can do the same thing. If it is difficult for an animal to cross a river, the genes in populations on either side of the river can drift apart, just as one language can drift to become two dialects, which can later drift to become two languages. Mountain ranges can play the same role of separation. So can just plain distance.